You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio in every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast by Free Speech TV as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide. More people watching or listening to this program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Welcome back to our program, or welcome to today's program. A lot going on that we're going to get to. In fact, something I wanted to correct from yesterday. And by the way, to our Pacifica listeners, I know the people watching us on TV got today's newscast. Our Pacifica listeners got yesterday's newscast. My apologies. We just moved our studios a week before last, and we're still finding the bugs here and there. Professor Robert Reich is on the line with us, former U.S. Labor Secretary, Chancellor, Professor of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. Prolific author of 13 books, including his latest, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. And, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future, The Work of Nations. And the new ebook, Beyond Outrage. You can read all about it at Robert Reich, R-E-I-C-H.org, his website. And Secretary Reich, welcome back to the program. Or Professor
Hello,
Reich.
Tom.
Great to have you with us. You wrote a piece and asked a question, and it's a question that I very often get into fights with libertarians about. What is an economy for? I would love to hear you riff on this.
Well, an economy is for the people who comprise the economy. It's not for the stock market. Although the stock market is sometimes taken as a measure of the economy's strength, it's not the stock market. It's not Wall Street. The economy is not corporations. It's not the income of corporations. The economy is the well-being of average working people in that society, and also the extent to which the earnings and the benefits and the growth of the economy are widely distributed to as many people as possible. To participate in the growth and the productivity improvements of that economy. In other words, an economy is people. It is not corporations.
Yeah, and we the people give corporations certain privileges in exchange for operating within our economy. In the used to be the demand, I guess now it's the hope that they will return some social good to us.
Well, yes. I mean, a democracy is supposed to represent the people, and the people through a democracy are supposed to set the rules of the game through which corporations and other actors in the economy play, so as to make sure that the results of all of their actions redound to the benefit of the people. In other words, you can't separate politics from economics to the extent that politics really does reflect us and reflect our needs. And that's essentially the problem today, because so much income and wealth are now at the top. Big corporations and Wall Street have so much political power to influence our democracy that average people and their voices are being completely overridden.
Yeah, and yet when I ask people like Stephen Moore, the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, or Yaron Brook, the president of the Ayn Rand Society, which is more important, democracy or capitalism, they invariably say capitalism.
Well, you cannot have one without the other. That is, I think that conservatives are probably correct. If you have a society that is organized totally around government and run by government, and where government owns all of the economy, then everybody is going to be so dependent on government that there is no real opportunity for independence that you need for freedom. So, yes.
Didn't work out well for East Berlin or the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they've got that right. But what they don't understand is you cannot have capitalism without democracy. I mean, who is going to set the rules of the game? Who's going to define what it is that means private property? And unless you have a democracy that is active and vital and independent, there's no way that capitalism is going to function within bounds. It's going to move toward excess. It's going to create huge booms followed by great busts. it's going to lead to depressions and recessions and have all sorts of negative consequences, such as pollution and unsafe products and unsafe jobs, because nobody knows better. There is no guiding principle. There is no constraint.
Right now, there are more people in the United States working for and owning a piece of worker-owned co-ops than there are people who are members of unions. And the United Steelworkers Union has jumped into this with both feet. They've got a couple of factories that they're in the process of converting to worker-owned union member cooperatives. And SEIU, I guess, is working on one, on a hospital, I think it is, out on the West Coast. Do you see that as an alternative to capitalism that is, you know, strong and viable here in the United States?
Well, I would say, I don't want to mince words, Tom. I think that's a form of capitalism which workers
control the capital.
Own individual companies, but the companies are still competitive with one another. It's still important to show a profit because you have to have a profit in order to plow back the investment. That's capitalism. It just happens to be worker-owned capitalism, and that's a form that may have a very, very bright future if we can get around one handicap, one problem. And that is that if the company goes down, then workers in that company have all their eggs in that one basket, and they end up worse off than they would be otherwise. So if we can kind of spread the risk a little bit, insure those companies against losses, then I think that those workers would be in much, much better shape. I think worker-owned cooperatives really are a wave of the future.
Yeah. What do you see as the biggest issue facing the United States right now, economically and politically?
I think it's inequality. Inequality that has got so outrageously lopsided that the top 1% is taking home more money and wealth than it's taken home at any point in the last 80 years. But that means, you see, political power, and that political power is enough to reduce their taxes and to shred safety nets and to get rid of a lot of things that most everybody else needs, like Medicare and Social Security, good education, an infrastructure that is working for everyone, and at the same time gives them the political power to make people believe through the repetition of big lies on the broadcast networks they own or they sponsor, that people's enemies are other working people just like themselves, unionized workers or government workers or workers who are near or at the minimum wage or immigrants. You see, the oldest trick in the book is making people feel that their enemies are the people just like them and taking their eyes away and distracting their attention from the big story, the big issue, which is that all of the wealth and all of the income, or nearly all of it, from growth, from productivity improvements, have been going to the top 1%, and a big portion to the top 0.1%. So, Tom, that's the essential economic and political problem we are trying to cope with. We need to cope with. I don't think we're trying to cope with it. I think we have to cope with it.
And in the half a minute we have left, Professor Reich, what should we be doing?
Well, in a half a minute, it's going to be hard to say.
Okay.
I think there's no magic bullet. We've got to enlarge the earned income tax credit, which is a tax, kind of a worker subsidy. We've got to raise taxes on the wealthy. We've got to resurrect the Glass-Steagall Act and break up the big banks. We've got to make sure that it's easier to form unions and stop companies from their anti-union busting rampage they're on. We've got to make sure that it's not easy to outsource abroad and there are no tax breaks that encourage companies to outsource abroad. I could go on. We don't have the time. There's no magic bullet, but above all, we've got to get money out of politics, big money, and we've got to organize and mobilize and energize average working people, poor people, the old working class, to take back our economy and to reclaim our democracy.
So well said. You can read all about it at robertreich.org. Professor Reich, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you again. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I want to correct something I said yesterday about states' rights and gay marriage right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my. What I wanted to share with you, yesterday at one point toward the end of the show, we had been talking about marriage equality throughout the show. And in the third hour of the program, as I recall, somebody called in and wanted to know about, President Obama said this is a state's issue, and what do we do? And I said, well, most marriage laws are state laws, and therefore it is largely a state's issue. Well, it is in that regard. I mean, every state has their own laws about marriage and all that kind of thing. But that said, there's also a federal issue. And I think that, to a certain extent, the president is addressing that by trying to stop DOMA, but the Defense of Marriage Act, which is really, or the Defense Against Marriage Act, this is really the law that was passed that says that defines marriage as a man and a woman. And it was kind of a preemptive strike by Republicans as a way of saying, don't you Democrats get any ideas, right? We're going to outlaw this. This was back, almost 20 years ago this was passed. So the White House is no longer enforcing it. And this is Loving versus Virginia. Well, actually, Pace versus Alabama is an interesting one, too. There are several. Pace versus Alabama was in 1883. Tony Pace, African-American man, Mary Cox, a white woman, residents of Alabama, were arrested in 1881 for miscegenation, for having sex across the racial divide. And they were sentenced to 2 years in prison in 1882. They appealed it to the Supreme Court. And in 1883, the United States Supreme Court said, yep, send them to jail. So those miscegenation laws stood, and they stood for a long, long time. And then finally in 1967, this case, which had actually been earlier prosecuted, the prosecution was 1959, and the defendants were Mildred Loving, an African-American woman, and Richard Perry Loving, a white man. And they, in 58, they went to D.C. to get married, where it was legal for mixed-race couples to get married. And then they moved back to Virginia in 59, and they were promptly arrested and convicted and sentenced to a year in prison unless they spent the next 25 years out of state or not seeing each other. So about a decade later, after it was argued in April 10th, 1967, and decided on June 12th, 1967. This was 3 years after the Civil Rights Act was passed and signed. The U.S. Supreme Court and Earl Warren, the Chief Justice, said no. Now, the earlier argument that had been made in Pace versus Alabama, and in fact in the trial, this 1959 trial, of this black woman and a white man who got married in Washington, D.C., and then Virginia prosecuted them for it when they moved there. That judge said, and I quote, Almighty God created the races white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them on separate continents, and but for the interference of his arrangements, there would be no cause for such marriages. The fact that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. Here's the religious argument again. But the Supreme Court looked at this and said, no, we're not going to go down that road. In fact, this is a quote from the ruling in Loving versus Virginia. Marriage is one of the basic civil rights of man, fundamental to our very existence and survival. To deny this fundamental freedom on so unsupportable a basis as the racial classifications embodied in our statutes is surely to deprive all the state citizens of liberty without due process of law. So, and then it goes on from there and quotes the 14th Amendment and whatnot. And basically what it's saying is that these people were born this way, and because they were born this way, they didn't have a choice in being white or black or whatever else it might be. And so you can't deny them the right to marry as a consequence of that. And I think that's where we're at now in the United States. And that's why I'm saying I think this is a federal issue as well as a state issue. The states obviously have to recalibrate their laws, just as they did after the Civil Rights Act was passed. I mean, this prosecution in 1959 in Virginia, where the Virginia judge convicted this couple, at the Lovings, ironic name, convicted them and sentenced them to a year in prison for simply being married when they were of opposite races. Not opposite, but different races. This judge in 1959 doing this was doing this based on a state law that still stood 4 years after, 5 years after Brown versus Board of Education was decided in 1954, which provided for or forced, depending on how you want to use your language, the integration of our school system. It was a decade and a half after Harry Truman. It was a generation after Harry Truman had integrated the military. So, you know, back then, even after Brown versus Board, it was still, you know, states were still pursuing their prerogative to their so-called states' rights to imprison people for getting married if they were of different races. And arguably, if a gay couple got married in a state where it's not legal and then claimed anything, you know, okay, we're going to claim a tax status, or we're going to claim, you know, any kind of benefit, that would be a violation of the law of the state or of the federal government, and they could go to jail, which is just fundamentally wrong. So I would say, correcting myself, this is not a states' rights issue. This is a federal issue. This needs to be decided at the federal level. This is about civil rights, pure and simple.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's about born that way, right? Get it? It's about born that way. This is civil rights. It's a beautiful. Meanwhile, Mitt Romney, this is hysterical. First of all, you know, Mitt comes out and, you know, has some things to say about the auto bailout comment. Actually, the president had something to say about Sir Romney's comment about how he's going to take all kinds of credit for the auto industry bailout. You'll recall we played that for you a couple of days ago, Mitt Romney saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to take a lot of credit for this. Well, here's what President Obama had to say about that yesterday.
Mitt Romney just recently said that he deserves the credit for the revival of the U.S. auto industry. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I think this is one of his etch-a-sketch moments. I don't think anybody takes that seriously. People remember his position, which was, let's let Detroit go bankrupt. So had we followed his advice at that time, GM and Chrysler would have gone under and we would have lost probably a million jobs throughout the Midwest.
There you go. And I think it would have been more than a million jobs, because there's that kind of knock-on effect, that echo effect. So that's one. There's a second, and that is that, you know, while the president is saying gay people should have rights, like the right to marry, and he has, you know, been on the record for a long, long time in defending other rights and you know, against discrimination and things. It's come out that when Mitt Romney was in this very, very fancy, very expensive Cranbrook prep school, he chased a gay kid who had long hair into an empty classroom, threw him to the floor, pinned him down, pulled out a pair of scissors, cut the kid's hair off while the kid was screaming and crying, you know, leave me alone, stop doing it. And then when the story came out, it was broken by the Washington Post, when this story came out, Romney says, well, I did some things I'm not so proud of as a kid, and I don't remember if this kid was gay or not. And then one of his high school buddies comes out and says he's lying. He does remember the kid was gay, and this was an anti-gay bullying by Mitt Romney. And now the Romney campaign has put out a call for Romney best friends from Cranbrook Prep School, who have a positive recollection of the times. You know, if I was running Mitt's campaign, I would have told him, just don't even respond to it in the first place, and it'll die out. Although, that's the advice that, you know, people like Bob Schrum gave John Kerry back in 2004. Oh, those Swift boat guys, those are, nobody's going to take that seriously. Come on, you got four war medals. You're a decorated veteran. You're a hero. So just ignore it. Anyhow, Romney's choosing not to ignore it, and I think it's going to bite him in the butt. So there's that. There's the economy. And speaking of the economy, in Wisconsin, the governor, Scott Walker, who has been, like all the Republican governors all around the United States, in an effort to make the economy worse so that people will experience pain and be angry at the president and follow through on Mitch McConnell's commitment that he made the day after President Obama was inaugurated, that the number one job of the Republican Party is, the entire party, is to make President Obama a one-term president. So Scott Walker had been doing his share, just like Rick Scott down in Florida, turning down millions of dollars for a high-speed rail between Tampa and Orlando, and up in Michigan, Rick Snyder, you know, devastating basically the state, laying off people. John Kasich down in Ohio, busting up unions and laying off people. Scott Walker, the same thing. And the federal government had offered a whole bunch of money to Wisconsin to rebuild, Milwaukee and some good stuff. And Scott Walker turned it down. He said, we don't have the state doesn't have the money for the matching funds. Well, now that his job's on the line, Scott Walker suddenly wants to put people to work in Wisconsin. Surprise, surprise. It's going to be really interesting to see if Wisconsinites buy it or if they see it as a desperate last-minute bribe. But Scott Walker does have $21 million that he's raised specifically from oil billionaires down in Texas and Wall Street billionaires in New York City that he's brought back to Wisconsin that he's going to try and use to win that election. And, time will tell. We'll see how this all plays out. But and by the way, my state's rights ramp. This is clip number four, Jacob. I was going off on how I don't think that marriage equality is a state's right. I think that, I acknowledge every state has laws on marriage and they define how it can be done and who can do it to a certain extent. And, who's ordained and who isn't or whatever, who has the authority. But that said, the right to marry has been defined by history, and most recently Loving versus Virginia, 1967, by the Supreme Court, as a fundamental federal right, as a human right. Well, here's what the Mitster had to say.
Yeah. I got married to marijuana. Those are state issues, right?
Thank you.
Are they really?
Yes. Yeah. Well, they could be federal issues.
They could be federal issues. Yeah, maybe. But Romney's not running on marriage and marijuana. I think he just kicked the libertarian vote to the curb, which is why Matt Taibbi's going on CNN saying, selection's over. Obama's won. It's in the bag. The networks are just trying to make it look like a horse race so that they can sell advertising. I wish it was that simple. But when you look at the potential of $1 billion being spent, it's not that simple, unfortunately. Bruce in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Bruce. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, you were talking about how Romney held that kid down and cut his hair or whatever.
Yeah.
How come you never mentioned Barack Obama doing lines when he was in high school?
Well, I think that that's A, it's an old story. B, it doesn't involve hurting another person or bullying somebody. And C, of course I would expect that the minute that I mentioned Mitt Romney's past, some Republican would call up and say, all right, let's see, page 322, the Republican playbook. Oh, here's the talking point in response to that. Obama started cocaine when he was a kid. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, so did I. So did a lot of people of that generation, of that age, and of others. And it doesn't make it right, and it doesn't. And Obama has said that clearly, and I'll say that too. And ain't a big deal. And as I said, I think that there's a fundamental difference between being violent against another human being, and and experimenting with drugs. Chris in St. Augustine, Florida. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, man, what an honor, dude. Hey, you know, I was calling. I want to digress a little bit. I wanted to comment on the first person you had on.
On Robert Reich's comments, yeah.
Yes, sir. You know, I was talking to your guy there, and I was asking him, you know, you guys have mentioned several different examples of where the economy had done terrible under government intervention. But is there an example outside of the existing example that we see today where a corporate run amok economy has done terrible?
Well, yeah, the Great Depression of 1929, the Great Depression of right now. I think that there's no end and no shortage of them. And that was the point that Robert Reich was making. There is no such thing as you could say there is such a thing as a government-run economy. The USSR tried it. It didn't work. Nobody's advocating that. There's no such thing as a purely corporate-run economy, although there are libertarians who want that. But it has never been tried successfully in any country on Earth, and if it was, it wouldn't work, which is why it's never been tried successfully. I mean, it's been tried, but it's never been successful. And to the extent it's been tried, it's called kingdoms and oligarchies. It's like the rich people take over, right? And then appoint themselves as kings or as lords or as oligarchs or as dictators. I mean, you could argue Saddam Hussein, but the bottom line is that government creates an economy by creating currency, by creating the rules for the economy, the laws that this is what is fraud, this is what isn't fraud, this is what you may do, this is what these words mean in contracts, things like that, and providing a court system to enforce those contracts and make things work. It's pretty straightforward stuff. David in Suffield, Connecticut, listening to WHMP. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I'd like to know, what can everybody do today to stop the attempt of defunding social services to support the industrial military complex?
I think the main thing is to work to, you know, the first thing that came through my mind was, you know, vote all the Republicans out of office. But it's worse than that. even you know, if you had nothing but Democrats in office, I'm guessing that a faction of them would become, beholden to big money, because there's just so much money sloshing around in government right now. And in fact, some are already. And so really what we need to do is we need to get the money out of government. And the easy, straightforward, simple way to get money out of government is to roll back this doctrine that was created by the Supreme Court back in the 1860s and has been brought into full fruition with the 2010 Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court.
Oh, I agree with that. But what can we do today to stop what they're attempting to do right now today?
Well, it's...
Who can we call and tell them that we don't want them doing what they're attempting to do?
It's sort of like Susan B. Anthony and friends sitting around back in 1887 and saying, how do we get the vote for women? It doesn't, it's not going to happen tomorrow as the result of something you do today, but it will happen months or years down the road if you, for example, go to movetoamend.org and sign up and say, I'm going to participate in this, and join one of the very, there's a whole bunch of groups that are now part of the coalition of Move to Amend. To amend our Constitution, to say corporations are not people and money is property, not speech.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And this is frankly really important stuff. And let me just add, we're not going to be saved by some big daddy politician. It's always movement politics.
The worst is yet to come, babe, won't it be bad? We've killed the fish, the plants, and now I'm getting mad.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the sane among us. I got a note a while back from Tim Carpenter, who is the grand poobah at Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org is their website. And he said, last year in partnership with OurChildrensTrust.org, and a fellow by the name of Alec Lors, and Kids versus Global Warming and other youth plaintiffs sued the federal government for failing to protect the atmosphere and thus their future. This is based on the public trust doctrine. Alec Lors is with us. He's a student at El Camino High School in Ventura, California, and the founder of the I Matter movement. He founded Kids versus Global Warming when he was 12 years old. I Matter is imattermarch.org is their website. And Alec, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us about, first of all, what is iMatterMarch.org all about?
Yeah, so I've been a climate change activist for my entire teenage life. I'm actually 17 now. I'm not at El Camino High School anymore. I think that we have so many old bios going around.
Ah, okay.
But yeah, so I started this organization called Kids Versus Global Warming and iMatter when I was about 13, and I started doing a lot of speaking, and I decided I wanted to be, you know, I kind of made this commitment that I wanted to devote myself to stopping global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been involved as an activist for about 5 years now, and I guess about 2 years ago I felt the need for something bigger. Like, I just was starting to feel uncomfortable with just asking for, you know, people to change light bulbs and ride bikes and all that sort of stuff. So iMatter organized this huge campaign called the iMatter March, where youth marched in over 200 communities more worldwide. And that was also when I became involved in this lawsuit. So yeah, I could tell the story of the lawsuit if you'd like.
Yeah, I would love to. The basis of the lawsuit was what? You were suing the federal government, the U.S. government. Why?
Yeah, so we're basically suing the federal government for failing to protect the atmosphere as a public trust. And it's based in this legal theory called atmospheric trust litigation,
mm-hmm.
which was developed by a Professor Mary Wood at the University of Oregon. And it basically says that our government has the legal responsibility to protect our atmosphere for present and future generations.
And not just responsibility, but obligation.
They have the legal obligation to do that. And we basically are saying that our burning of fossil fuels and the resulting consequences with climate change are not only a moral travesty, but are actually illegal under the public trust doctrine. So the case was filed actually a year ago this week, last May 4th. And we've gone through a lot of, it's been a nice journey throughout the year. And last month, the big news this month is the National Association of Manufacturers, which is one of the country's biggest fossil fuel lobbying groups, and these five other huge lobbying groups intervened in the case to fight us, basically arguing that they have the right to emit as much as they want. We're saying, you know, that's not only morally wrong, but it's actually illegal. So they and the defendants, which are our six executive agencies of the U.S. government, have filed a motion to dismiss our case on the grounds that we don't have the legal standing or something to bring it to court.
Right.
But they're actually not arguing that climate change isn't even real. They're just saying that this is too big for the courts and we should go to Congress, where they know that it's just such a stalemate that we wouldn't get anything through. So they filed that motion to dismiss last month, and the hearing is tomorrow.
May 11th.
24 hours tomorrow morning. So I'm here in Washington. I've been on the Hill for the past couple days. Yesterday, we met with a bunch of congressmen and members of Congress, and today I'm actually standing right in front of the White House right now, about to go in. And yeah, it's really an exciting week. It's really cool because we were meeting with the congressman yesterday, and today we're at the White House, and a member of our team actually personally delivered a letter to President Obama last week. And then tomorrow we have the hearing for this court case. So we're actually exercising our rights as American citizens in all three branches of government this week.
Which court are you arguing this in before?
It's the U.S. District Court in D.C.
So it's the First Circuit.
Yeah. And basically, tomorrow, if the case isn't dismissed, we'll kind of go on to the next level. I'm actually still not completely sure the actual legal terms for everything. But yeah, it's the lawyers are actually really hopeful, and everyone's. I mean, just the fact that these huge lobbying groups have joined on to fight us just tells you that they actually are taking it seriously.
Yeah, well, they're freaked out about the fact that we, the people who created this government to protect the commons of our nation, might actually protect the commons of our nation.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, what kind of gall is that?
You know, I know.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
And I think it's fabulous that, you know, high school students, young people are suing the federal government to say, please do your job. I'm sure it's horrifying, you know, some within the government who would prefer just to have $300 bottles of wine with lobbyists at fancy restaurants here in D.C., but not specifically talking about Paul Ryan. I'm just talking about Paul Ryan. But I'm sure it would horrify some of them. But, I think this is a really good and important thing. So you will let us know how this thing comes out, how it works out tomorrow?
Definitely, yeah. If you sign up on our Facebook page, facebook.com/imattermarch, we'll be giving out or we'll be giving info about that. We have an event tonight, a pre-rally hearing with speakers and all the.
Where is that? Where and when?
It's at Busboys and Poets in D.C. tonight.
Which one?
Eight.
Is that the Busboys and Poets up on U or V Street?
I think so. It's the one sort of near the convention center.
Oh, okay. I think that's the other one. That's the one that's down near 5th and F or thereabouts. But anyway, you can call Busboys and Poets and get the information. Alan Lors, yes. The website imattermarch.org, Alec Lors. Right. Thank you, Alec.
Great. Thank you very much.
Keep up the great work.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Arthur Brooks is on the line with us. He's the president of the American Enterprise Institute. And he has a new book out, The Road to Freedom. Arthur, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Great to. I'm fine. Great to have you back with us. In The Road to Freedom, you're creating a moral case for free enterprise. Isn't there a stronger moral case to be made for restraining or at least regulating free enterprise so that it operates to the benefit of the people rather than just a few?
Well, no. I mean, I think that there's a very strong case that we should start making for free enterprise per se. I think it would be a favor to your side if we did. I mean, as it's been over the past 25 or 30 years, the arguments that we've been having have been largely moral arguments from the left that have been matched by materialistic arguments from the right. And I think it's been really hard to sort out what the key issues are. I mean, I think you guys on the left would be much better served if you heard what was written on our hearts about what we think is so great about the free enterprise system.
Since Reagan introduced Reaganomics 30 years ago, we've seen the top 1% have a 570% increase in their income, whereas the bottom 80% have been not only flat but have fallen. We've seen average individual income in the United States almost cut in half. It's now $26,000 a year. Household income has been flat. But that's because you've got, you know, married people or, you know, multiple wage earners in a home. Reaganomics has really devastated the middle class, although it's done very, very well for the wealthy 1% who support your perspective. I don't see how that's a moral argument.
Well, there's a lot to be said for the moral argument for bringing everybody into a greater opportunity society. I mean, we hear a lot about the concerns that you have, and I understand your concerns, and, you know, everybody listening to us today who is disproportionately political progressives, they're really concerned about income inequality and the stuff that you talk about here. But you really hit on what we should be caring about. The real moral significance is not income inequality, it's actual mobility and opportunity for people at the bottom. That's what we need to be thinking about. What is the system that's going to enable that to happen the best?
Now, I absolutely agree. And in fact, I can tell you from, you know, being an entrepreneur back in the 70s and the 80s when, the first business I owned in 1973, we bought health insurance for all our employees at Blue Cross Blue Shield in Michigan. And my recollection is it was like $35 a person per month, for a good family plan, because back then the state of Michigan required all health insurance companies to be not-for-profit, required all hospitals to be not-for-profit. Given that one of the greatest barriers to mobility and certainly one of the greatest barriers to people quitting their job and becoming entrepreneurs like I did is that they're afraid that they may get sick and they may lose their health insurance. And now, you know, once COBRA has expired, you know, more than 100 million people have pre-existing conditions. that just kind of writes them out of the gene pool of possibilities to become entrepreneurs. Isn't the best thing to do to ensure that mobility that you're talking about to have a national healthcare system?
Well, look, you just conflated two things. Should we have portability? Should we have something that guards against people having pre-existing conditions being able to change their jobs? Oh, yeah.
How are you going to do that without government?
But without what we're talking about is actually a system in which you have insurance reform, not the nationalization of the healthcare system. Look, if you want to see what insurance reform looks like that really does protect against pre-existing conditions and allows portability, go to AEI.org and you'll see how we think about that. And you know what, Tom? I bet you'd agree with 95% of the stuff that we're talking about.
Can you show me an example?
Tom, I think I agree with you on something that's huge. That you have the most important radio show on the left. And the thing I know that bugs you the most is corporate cronyism. It's a huge threat to liberty, and you're completely right. And that's the reason that a lot of these health insurance markets have gotten completely out of control. I mean, a lot of health insurers have completely captured state legislators. They're too much in the pocket.
Arthur, in my opinion, that's the consequence,
right,
of the Supreme Court having come up with this doctrine back in the 1880s that they've amplified now to the point of hysteria that corporations are persons and that money is not property, it's actually speech, which is complete absurd nonsense. But back to this point, can you identify for me one country that has ever said, okay, we're not going to, and one developed country, one undeveloped country for that matter, that has said, you know, the government's not going to involve itself in the healthcare market. We're just going to let free enterprise take care of it, and it's been successful.
No, the government has to be involved in the provision of public goods. The question is whether or not it can leave the parts that are best left up to the markets, and we've never tried that. We've actually never tried to create conditions where health insurers really compete against each other, as opposed to trying to capture the government.
We had unregulated health insurance in the United States for half the 20th century.
Yeah, the unregulated health insurance.
And it was a disaster.
Anybody listening to this recognizes the so-called unregulated health insurance markets are ones where you can't even trade a health insurance contract across state lines.
No, those are regulated. Those are ones where you actually have individual states who have insurance commissioners and they look out for the interests of the people in their states. I thought you guys on the right were concerned about states' rights.
Me? In New York State, I can't even get a catastrophic health care policy for less than thousands of dollars a year because the health insurance coverers, which have captured the state legislators, say that they have to cover all kinds of crazy conditions that nobody even wants.
So you're going on record as being an opponent of states' rights.
I'm going on record as being an opponent of the laws passed under McCarran-Ferguson in the 40s, you know them better than I do, that say that you can't trade across states. We need actually health insurers to be able to...
You want the federal government to tell individual states that their insurance commissioners no longer have the power to regulate how insurance is handled in their states. You don't think that these things should be local. You think that they should be done from the White House.
I want real interstate commerce, and if we're going to have regulation on these things, we need to have uniform regulations, just as we have in trucking, just as we have in utilities.
Just as we have in credit cards? Really what you're talking about is the credit card model. We used to allow individual states to regulate credit card companies. Credit card companies got that knocked down in, what, the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s? I'm not sure exactly when it was, but it was in the middle of the 20th century. And the consequence of that was that every state had different standards. The state with the lowest common denominator was North Dakota. All the credit card companies opened an office in North Dakota and said, this is where our headquarters are. These are the rules we have to comply with. And now you can get hit with a 30% interest rate on your credit card, which when Richard Nixon was president, he called usury and tried to send people to jail for.
Yeah, well, you know, in health insurance markets, what the government needs to do is to make sure that we have an insurability pool. Look, the key thing that we need to keep in mind in all of these ideas is what is the proper role for government? And this feeds into the broader conversation that we're having. You know, what is it that free enterprise advocates need to be able to say to make a truly moral case that can be so that you guys understand
I'm still listening
exactly
for
why we care about it? It's too easy for people on the left and right to caricature each other as sellouts and shills. You know, I work with a lot of people on left and right, especially a lot of people on the right. Let me tell you, they have honestly held moral views about freedom, opportunity, and free enterprise.
I don't disagree with that statement at all. I believe that they're wrong. I believe that you're wrong.
Of course,
but
you
I
do.
But I respect your right to hold those opinions and the fact that many of the people on the right actually do believe what they're saying. There are some, I think, on both sides who are, you know, dancing to the tune of the piper that's paying them. But that
I'm kidding.
No, yeah, right. But, you know, that said, I think, you know, we need these conversations more. But I still have not heard, and we're just flat out of time. We have hard breaks here, and I know any minute now the machine is going to start and it's going to step on both of us. But I haven't heard any country where this has worked. Can you name one?
Where we actually have had an unregulated health insurance market?
Or, you know, where your idea of a health insurance market that's run by for-profit corporations has succeeded?
When for-profit corporations can actually compete with each other, you have variations.
Has it
that.
Ever worked in any country?
Well, without any regulation of the for-profit insurers?
No, whatever qualifications you want to put on it, has your ideal been tried ever anywhere?
You have to tell me. I mean, I don't know how you're defining it, Tom.
Well, I would think that you'd be able to say, okay, here, Sweden, take a look at what they, or, you know, or
okay,
Nicaragua, they did it.
Switzerland is run largely by corporations. I mean, the health insurance market is run largely by a regulated system of corporations.
Okay, Arthur Brooks. Hang on just a second, Arthur.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The new book is The Road to Freedom. He's the president of the American Enterprise Institute, AEI.org. Arthur, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
Oh, geeky science. That's right, it's Thursday, the second segment of the second hour of our Thursday. I get 3 minutes to talk about one of my favorite topics on Earth, geeky science. And this study just came out. It was published, it was done by McMaster Institute for Music and the Mind. And McMaster University, and what they found was that when young children, we're talking very young, we're talking under a year and a half old, when babies are exposed to music, and not just exposed to music, this isn't just the Mozart effect, if you remember that book from a couple of decades ago, of, you know, playing music to babies in the womb or when they're first born and all that kind of thing, but if they actually interact with the music, if you teach them musical lessons, if you hum along with them, if you sing along with them, that not only do the babies pick up music really quickly, but other things happen. Their social communication, their social development is significantly better than babies who are not exposed to music. In fact, they said the non-musical differences between the two groups of babies were even more surprising, say researchers. Babies in the interactive class showed better communication skills, early communication skills like pointing at objects that are out of reach or waving goodbye. Socially, these babies also smiled more, were easier to soothe, and showed less distress when things were unfamiliar or didn't go their way. Simply by being not just exposed to music, but interacting with music. Frankly, I mean, the study didn't draw any of these conclusions. This is purely mine. But one of the things that we know is that there are, you know, the parietal portion of the brain, the side chunks of the brain, are where we process music and language. And we process language in the left-hand side, which is called Broca's region, and we process music in the right-hand side called Wernicke's region. And all stimulus into the brain goes first through the right side and then into the left side, and which is a whole other interesting thing. So it has to go through the right to get to the left. And if you're stimulating just the left, in other words, if you're just talking, that's Broca's region. If you're just singing, that's Wernicke's region. But if you're doing both, if you're stimulating both, then you're getting bilateral development. You're stimulating and developing both sides of the brain. And the other thing that we know is the brains are incredibly plastic, particularly the younger you are, although plasticity in the brain, they used to think it ends with puberty. Now we know that the brains of 70-year-olds are plastic. People's brains are constantly capable of actually growing and developing. Not just, you know, doomed to eternal shrinkage, but growing and developing, you know, new neural pathways, new learnings. It's one of the reasons why it's so important to keep your mind stimulated by things like talk radio, talk TV, talk radio. But anyhow, I think that my guess on the mechanism of this is that music that has words associated with it is bilateral stimulation. And I wrote an entire book on bilateral stimulation of the brain. It's called Walking Your Blues Away. And if any of this rings bells for you or you think might be interesting, let me recommend that to you. Anyhow, 866-97-THOM, our telephone number. And Malcolm in Park Forest, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Malcolm, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? I'm still feeling like that that voice in the wilderness like John the Baptist, that no one is hearing. I talk to you about it from time to time.
Well, one guy heard John the Baptist and changed the world, so you never know.
That's right, right. So, you know, I'm going to, you know, travel down memory lane with you, and we've talked about this before. I think that we need to simplify and clarify our message as liberals or progressives, whatever we call ourselves, and start to educate people to the fact that what's happening now is really revenge for the New Deal. And a lot of people, kids, don't know what the New Deal was.
Yep.
They don't realize that the rich have been mad as hell about that ever since when FDR sicked the army on the goons and thugs that were trying to beat up on people who were on strike in General Motors.
You're right.
They've been mad about that. That's when they got together and formed this coup to overthrow the Roosevelt administration. And one of those was the chairman of the board of General Motors, I think. And one of the DuPonts.
Sure who it was. They held congressional hearings into it. And just when they were about to get to who was behind it, President Roosevelt actually stopped the hearings. But Smedley Butler, the Marine general who was...
He's the one that blew the whistle on it.
Yeah, he's the guy who blew the whistle. And for those people who don't know who Smedley Butler is, you should Google him. Because in 1935, you know, or 33 when this happened, 33, 34 when this happened, Smedley Butler was a retired Marine general. And he was as famous as Eisenhower was for those people, you know, who remember Eisenhower. Or as famous as what would be one of the generals from the Iraq War or something? General
McChrystal. Yeah, well, I really called to answer the question of the guy who asked you, what could we do about what's happening now? And that's what we need to do. We need to start getting the kids in the living room and gather around the fire and start teaching them about FDR, the New Deal, and how he changed things, and how people now who have gotten filthy rich on our intelligence, our blood, sweat, and tears, want to turn around and destroy what you call the sovereign national state. These people do not like the concept of a sovereign national state with its inherent ability to regulate its own affairs and to produce, manufacture, and distribute the goods and services.
Malcolm, you're absolutely right. And in fact, Franklin Roosevelt pointed out that these people hated him. Here's what he had to say.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
And that's, Malcolm, what we need to be teaching the next generation, is that there was once a president who spoke like that.
I wish we could go to the grave and resurrect that guy. We could use him right now. But
well, but the fact of the matter is that he could only do it because the people were with him.
Right. Well, we're going to have to start talking about our sovereignty and our security as a nation and relate that to what's happening with Citizens United, these traitors on the Supreme Court, and what the banksters are doing. They are trying to deliberately destroy this country. We're going to have to realize that, let that sink in informally. And I think one way to do it is to put pressure on the Justice Department and what's his name, the head of the Justice Department, the president, to start investigating these things and make it a security issue.
Yeah, Eric Holder, by the way. Yes, I agree with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We will be right back. It is 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. How should an economy be organized? Oh, it's fascinating, all of these stories about Mitt Romney's youth coming out. Faisal F. Al-Abuljadar, a Kuwaiti student, speaking of his senior year at Cranbrook, in part to improve his English, said the teachers and students went out of their way to treat him with respect, showing consideration for his celebration of Ramadan and bathing requirements. But he acknowledged being angry about a caption under his picture in the senior yearbook that read, "Take a left at the next synagogue." It's just Gustav Mahler is sharing these things in the chat room right now, all these stories that came out of Cranbrook. And basically what it was is a bunch of very pampered, rich kids who slapped down teachers and knew that there would be no consequence, Mitt Romney among them. So... And then he drags this gay kid into this room and cuts his hair off. The kid is screaming and crying. He's bullying a gay kid. And he, when asked about it, he says, well, I'm not the same person now that I was then, or words to that effect. Maybe not. Or maybe so. Joe in Springville, Utah. Hey, Joe, what's up? Joe? No Joe. Okay. Dwight in Nyland, California. Hey, Dwight, what's on your mind? Dwight?
Yes.
You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. I'm sorry. I got wrapped up in the...
No, it's quite all right. It's been a while since I've taken a call here, and everybody on hold has been there for a half hour or longer. So.
Yeah, let me go fast, then I'll let others on. I may be picking a nit here, but if we base marriage equality on civil rights, that people were born that way without a choice, so they, you know, what do we do with, do we then deny marriage to those who have chosen homosexuality as a lifestyle?
Well, you have to, first of all, demonstrate to me and to the scientific community that anybody chooses it.
Oh, goodness. I know, especially women. I know numbers of women who have, their life experiences have led them to prefer the companionship of other women to what they've experienced with men.
That may be. Then let's, I definitely don't think that that's the case with men. And
no, it very so. I can't imagine choosing that as a lifestyle.
And I don't think, I think for the majority of lesbian women, it is also not a choice. I think
I'm talking about a small universe.
We're talking about a subset. If you wanted to argue about that, then I would simply say, isn't getting married a choice?
Absolutely. But
okay, so if we're going to guarantee that choice, shouldn't we guarantee it for everybody?
Everyone. That's my point. Everyone. It's a slippery slope of making people prove they were born pacifists, you know, the old...
Oh, sure. I'm not suggesting that absolutely every gay person was born gay, but I do believe that the vast majority of them were. And
I think the overwhelming majority, yes.
Sure. And I suppose, you know, I mean, if you wanted to take the ad absurdio, if that's the Latin, if I'm remembering it right, portion of that argument, you could say, well, you know, how did, back during the days of slavery, how did they deal with African-Americans who were albinos? You know, they lacked pigmentation.
Yeah, I think
it
was called, wasn't it 1/16th or 1/32nd or something?
Yeah, they actually did
codify that.
Exactly. Various states had various rules, and they got around that. But
well,
I just
prefer the argument that marriage is a moral issue, and let's anyone who wants to get married ought to be able to get married. It's a civil matter, not a religious matter.
Amen. Okay. Well, and I agree with you, and we'll leave it at that. Dwight, thanks for the call. Armin in Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
What do you mean, what's up? I disagree with you.
Okay. Go for it.
Let me tell you something about these people that want to pander to these poor, downtrodden immigrants that you like to refer to as brown skin. The people, these supposed proponents like Pelosi, Reid, these, quote, liberals, why don't they spend all their money down? They're multimillionaires, and the Kennedys, they never spend their money down. What they do is they play this facade for
Armin,
the people that
believe. Armin, you are an angry, frightened man.
Now, I'm not getting health care, but I'm being taxed for people that aren't even citizens to get it, and you, Tom Hartman, think that's okay.
That
makes me suspect you, Tom.
Well, Armin, I will tell you right up front, I believe that anybody who's in the United States, legally or illegally, if they are bleeding,
before the taxpayer.
Let me finish my sentence. If they are bleeding,
that's what you believe.
If they are bleeding, we should stop their bleeding. If a child is in the United States, not by their own choice, and they have, you know, children have basic needs, and among them is education.
The household and mommy and
their
daddy.
Education should be available to them. I think that we don't have an immigration problem in this country. We have an illegal employer problem in this country. And no, we're not going broke, Armin. We have lots and lots of money. It is just being concentrated in the hands of the top 1%.
You condone non-citizens having their rights and needs met before the people that pay for it. And that's why the country's so screwed up.
Okay. Armin, if you believe that, I guess we do disagree. Because, A, that's not my position. And, B, I don't think that's anybody's position. I mean, that is a bizarre right-wing talking point of some kind, and which surprises me coming from you, Armin, because I know that you're not generally a crazy right-winger. Loretta in Kelso, Washington. Hey, Loretta, what's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say thank you to Alec at iMatters for his incredible work.
Mm-hmm.
That's so inspiring.
Yeah.
But also I'm calling because in order to fight against corporate personhood and the oil, grain, and seed cartels, we have to build and maintain solidarity amongst the 99%.
Yep.
Excuse me. But the certain communities have issues that make this difficult. For example, in Longview, we have the coal terminal possibly coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could talk about the ways that, I mean, the labor is fighting for this coal terminal, and they have good reasons to do that. Basically,
sure, they want jobs. The argument that I would make, Loretta, is that if government were to do what government did in the 1930s and become the employer of last resort, if we were to say as a nation, you know, if the private sector won't provide jobs, government will, because there's certainly a lot that needs to be done. We've got roads falling apart. We've got bridges falling down. We've got hospitals that are old and crumbling. We've got schools that don't work. There's so much that needs to be done. 30 years of Reaganomics, 30 years of negligence, neglecting our infrastructure, that we could put everybody back to work tomorrow. And once you do that, then those people who are being played against unemployment,
yeah,
those people where the coal barons or the steel barons or the whatever, you know, fill in the blanks of the industry, some dirty industry, come in and say, you know, if you don't let us have this coal miner, if you don't let us have this nuclear waste dump, or you don't let us have this fill in the blank, you're not going to have jobs. Those people wouldn't be able to say that anymore, and people would have a choice of what kind of jobs they want to have, and then you would see people pushing back. So, Loretta, that's my take on that. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
All the time. You got to talk me off the ledge, okay?
Okay.
And at the end of this conversation, I got to ask you a very important question. Please don't forget to let me do that. Now, the American middle class hasn't had an appreciable raise in income for 30 years.
Right. Right? Almost 35, actually, yes.
And you're poking them in the chest with your legislation. You come out and chastise them.
Me? With my legislation?
Food stamps when they're working. And about the health care, how they should afford health care for their family, and you keep poking them.
Wait a second, Corky. Wait a second. Let me just push back on some of your, Corky, some of your premises are wrong. Obamacare, for example, you're saying, you know, if you're echoing the Sean Hannity talking point that we're forcing working class people to buy health insurance, it's wrong. It's a lie. That's not true. People,
I'm
they're
not doing that.
If you're 200% of the poverty level, The federal government will be buying your health insurance for you.
Yes, I agree with that. That's what I'm saying. But you're poking the middle class. You haven't given them any raise to afford anything for the last 30 years. And you tote the accolades of the Second Amendment.
Who's the you that you're talking about here?
What do you think happens when people get hungry and sick?
I think they get angry.
Yeah, what happens when they get angry? That's what concerns me.
Well,
this is total insanity what the Congress is doing.
Yeah, the most dangerous person is a person who has nothing to lose, or who believes they have nothing to lose.
Does.
Pardon?
Now, can I ask you that question?
Sure.
Did you go and look at my videos on YouTube, broadcast yourself? They're PG. I'd like you to leave me a message what you think.
Okay.
There's three comedies and one rant.
Okay, Corky, I'll check it out. Thanks a lot. Michael in Santa Monica, we got a minute to the break, Michael.
I'll sign that in a minute. Hello, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah, the mailman just got here. I've got...
Aha, okay.
Sorry about that. I just wanted to, you know, say I haven't heard anything about Romney's job at Bain Capital and how... To me, it seemed like it was like Carl Icahn.
Yeah, you know, it was basically a pump and dump operation. You know, you buy a company, strip it, you know, pump it up strip it down first of all, take out all the money, load it up with debt, and then you know, grow it to the point where you can sell it and have the company absorb the debt. You don't take the debt, you take the profit. It's a very, very, you know, the vulture capitalism is incredibly profitable. That's why Mitt Romney made, you know, $20 million last year, $15 million. And only paid 14% and change in income tax on it. It's incredible. Can you imagine every other week or every third week getting $1 million deposited in your checking account? That was Mitt Romney's year last year. And only paying a maximum 15% income tax and no Social Security taxes on it. Gee, life is good when you're Mitt.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And then, you know, of course, if you like to fire people, you get to fire people, as Mitt apparently does. Talk Radio News coming up next.
That's what I want.
Jimi Hendrix? Wow. Flash in the past. Freedom. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And Ellen, greetings.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Listen, I happen to be in former Romney country, if you want to call it that, Massachusetts, where he was governor.
Uh-huh.
And as I was coming here, the news that he has been apologizing for his past behavior in high school, where apparently he was a bully and helped a gay man, made a gay man cut his hair, which he says he doesn't remember the incident, but knows that he was inappropriate, basically, in high school. I mean, I don't know how this guy survives this kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, okay. When I first brought this up, Ellen, in the first hour of the program, immediately I got a call from somebody saying, well, what about Barack Obama doing cocaine? I mean, Barry was doing lines. And, you know, of course, it was some, you know, one of these Republicans who listens to the show who goes, okay, talking point number 12, okay, call up and respond. But that's the Republican response. I mean, he's running against a guy who did coke as a teenager. What's the difference? Now, my response was there's a huge difference between experimenting with drugs and hurting another person. But,
well, that's number one. Number two, right. A drug is essentially a victimless crime. I mean, obviously drugs are not good things, but this is really quite astounding.
Yeah.
That this has finally come out, particularly when Romney gave his stance yesterday. You're right, the Republicans don't care. But it's that middle libertarian, younger voter that the Romney administration that the Obama administration knows that they've got in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that with the gay marriage issue, or the marriage equality issue more appropriately, I think that what President Obama has done, and the Democratic Party to a large extent, is peeled off a good chunk of the libertarians who have voted with Republicans, and now they're going to be reconsidering that. And hopefully they'll then reconsider their economics.
Right.
Anyhow, what else is going on?
Number one, the other big news that I have, and I'm a little limited on news, I've been doing a little traveling, is the Sheriff Arpaio issue. Now, the Justice Department is suing Sheriff Arpaio. I think this is only the second or third time that they have actually sued an entire department for discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
But they tried to negotiate with Sheriff Arpaio. This is the guy from Arizona. They were not successful. They insisted on federal oversight of his department. He absolutely refused. He's expected to do a press conference later on today. But basically, they're alleging that they simply pick up Hispanic drivers trying to find out whether they are undocumented people, that they are refusing to give translators to people who are picked up and need that while they're in prison or while they're in jail being held, etc., and basically a continued pattern of discrimination.
Well, and let's not forget his refusal to investigate sex crimes against women and girls who are Spanish-speaking.
Right. I don't know if that was actually in the thing. It might be. But in any case, I think Arpaio actually is in some pretty big trouble here. I don't see how he gets through federal court on this.
I think he's making himself a martyr and figuring that 3 years from now he's going to be a talk show host.
Well, you know, J.G. Hayworth, et cetera, have certainly made
Yeah, I mean, there's a precedent
Arizona.
For it. There's a precedent for it. So Although that went the other way around. But yeah, very interesting. Anything else in the news?
There is other things in the news, but unfortunately, I'm a little limited today because, as I said, I was traveling, so I apologize
for
that.
Let me share some news with you then, and you can riff on this. The last 12 months, did you get this report from NOAA, the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration, or National Oceanic and Atmospheric? From May 2011 until April 2012, last 12 months, the warmest 12 months ever recorded, an average temperature 2.8 degrees above the 100-year average. That, by the way, is in line with what they were predicting would happen with the current global warming. And the big warning that James Hansen said was, when it gets above 3 degrees, look out, because then it's starting to be like a snowball going down a hill where it gets bigger and bigger and bigger really, really rapidly.
Well, as you know, I was in with this group 2041 in Antarctica in March, and you cannot miss the effect of global warming. I actually spent one night camping out on the peninsula of Antarctica, and I have to tell you, you can hear all through the night these icebergs calving. We can't, well, first of all, 70% of the world's water is held in Antarctica, but secondly, what do we do when those oceans rise?
Yeah. Well, we should live in boats. Like I do. Okay, the average, but here's the kicker. The last year we've seen a 2.8, we're 2.8 degrees above the 100-year average. The average temperature for the last 4 months has been 5.4 degrees above the 100-year average, and the hottest period since record-keeping began. I mean, this is back in the 19th century. This is wild. This is scary wild. I'm wondering if you're hearing anything about how Scott Walker, how the people of Wisconsin are reacting to Scott Walker suddenly saying the president wanted to spend $100 million renovating Milwaukee, and Scott Walker turned it down back a year or so ago. Now he wants to spend that money.
Well, of course, because now he doesn't want his recall election to be successful.
Right.
I thought you were going to ask me about the other Scott Brown in Massachusetts.
Oh, well, go for that one. We have 30 seconds.
Quite a bit of news about him. It's interesting. The people I've been talking to in Massachusetts, as you know, I'm here almost every 2 weeks, say in terms of what essentially happened is that the and I'm blocking on her name, but the Democrat.
Elizabeth Warren, yeah.
Yes, basically what she did is she taught on television, and she taught on television, and people listened to her,
mm-hmm.
and she got quite a following, even among the sort of Romney middle,
huh.
And I think Scott Brown is going to have a very hard time making the kind of case that she did. His numbers are up. You know, right. He's now been interviewed. I think 60 Minutes is interviewing him.
Yeah, he's got the banksters and the billionaires, but
right.
We'll see. Ellen Ratner, we're out of time. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, goat for theoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, this is interesting. Michelle Bachmann just withdrew her Swiss citizenship. Amazing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Earlier this week, our intelligence agencies stopped a potential terrorist attack. Al-Qaeda's plan to blow up an American-bound airliner with an underwear bomb was stopped when the CIA caught wind of what was going on. At least that's what we think happened. Turns out that the guy who was going to blow up the plane was actually working for the CIA and the Saudi government, so he really wasn't a threat at all. But had it not been him, it might have been somebody who was. So, but in any case, putting that aside, we did just recently stop another bomber from taking down one of our airlines, and we did it this time without the help of the Saudis or an undercover CIA agent. We did it with good old-fashioned TSA detective work. I'll give you a hint. Their weapon of choice was not an underwear bomb, but it could have been a diaper bomb. Meet 18-month-old Rihanna, the latest threat to our nation's security.
A JetBlue employee told them they had to get off the plane. Agents from the Transportation Security Agency, the TSA, needed to speak to them.
And I said, for what? And he said,
well, it's not you or your husband. Your daughter was flagged as no fly. I said, excuse me?
It's absurd.
It made no sense.
Why would an 18-month-old child be on a no-fly list?
That's Rihanna's parents and the reporter for the TV station down there. The very thing that Representative Louis Gohmert was talking about when he warned us all about terror babies. What happened here, this couple got on this plane with their 18-month-old. They were taken off, and they were told, it's because your 18-month-old is suspicious. Now, mom was wearing a hijab, and, we'll get to that. Luckily, Rihanna's nefarious plot was foiled by the TSA on Tuesday before we lost a JetBlue flight out of Fort Lauderdale Airport. You see, the TSA had done its job and protected America by putting 18-month-old, not year-old, month-old Rihanna on a no-fly list before she could do any damage. Rihanna's parents, who are American citizens from New Jersey, just like their daughter, they were told they were free to fly, but they had to leave their terrorist Rihanna, 18-month-old, behind. Year-and-a-half-old kid. So, 1 point for America, 0 for the terrorists. And that's just the latest bomb plot foiled by the TSA. A few weeks ago, the TSA stopped another potential terrorist, 7-year-old Dina Frank, who suffers from cerebral palsy. Remember that one? Unlike Rihanna, Dina doesn't look like she's from Middle Eastern in descent, so this was an especially good catch by the TSA. She was stopped from boarding the plane and forced to miss her flight because the TSA had to make sure she didn't have plastic explosives stashed in her crutches. There was also a young boy who they thought maybe had a bomb wired to his wheelchair. That was a couple weeks ago. Thankfully, the TSA did their job of making America safe by feeling him up before he was capable of taking down an American airliner, too. So should we all take a moment right now and thank the TSA for groping one child after another so that we can all sleep better at night knowing our skies are safe from Louis Gohmert's terror babies? Of course, to all the Americans who aren't afraid of terror babies blowing up planes, then all this must look pretty damn silly. It must look like security theater. And when you're taking 18-month-old children off airplanes and groping disabled kids to check for bombs, and it's not just security theater, it's security theater of the absurd. And those of us who aren't living every day in fear of terrorists are taken aback by just how crazy and fearful the United States has become. How did we become a nation of frightened cowards? In my opinion, Bush and Cheney made us this way. Former National Security Advisor in the Clinton administration, Sandy Berger, told me, in fact, he told me out loud on this program, that Bill Clinton had told George W. Bush when they handed off the presidency to him in January 2001 that Osama bin Laden was planning to attack America and Bush should do something about it, that it should be his number one priority. Al Gore delivered the same message to Dick Cheney, as did Berger to Condi Rice. So Bush appointed Cheney to head up a task force to look into it in February 2001, but that task force never met until September of 2001. Instead, Cheney spent all his time working with oil industry executives, carving up the oil fields in Iraq before we even invaded there. So then in the summer of 2001, August 6th, the CIA became so alarmed that an attack on America by al-Qaeda was so imminent that they sent a special agent to Crawford, Texas, to personally brief President George W. Bush about it. Here's Condoleezza Rice describing the title of that briefing.
I really don't remember, Commissioner, whether I discussed this with the president.
And I ask you whether you recall the title of that PDB.
I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States.
There you go. By the way, the station that gave us the clip, or from who aired the clip of Rihanna was WPBF. So what did Bush do after we learned that New York and Washington, D.C. were almost certainly going to be attacked in the next few months? And he and Cheney had totally dropped the ball on doing anything to prevent it? What did he do? He decided to extend his presidential vacation in Texas out to be the longest presidential vacation in the history of the U.S. presidency. Then after almost a month with no attacks, Bush still had to do something. He had to go someplace, but he was still afraid to go to Washington, D.C. So instead, he flew to Florida, where his brother Governor Jeb Bush put the entire state on a high-security lockdown. And George W. Bush sat in Florida waiting for the attack. It came while he was in an elementary school classroom reading My Pet Goat to a group of kids. And then he sat there for 7 long minutes, scared out of his mind after hearing that the World Trade Center had gone down and another plane was heading across Pennsylvania towards Washington, D.C. When all that was done, he then hopped on Air Force One and hopscotched from Florida to Louisiana to Nebraska, afraid to set down very long anywhere, just picking up fuel and moving on. Scared to death. Cheney, meanwhile, was hiding in an underground bunker below the White House. And these two fearful and incompetent men have left us this horrible legacy. After flying around the country on Air Force One after 9/11 and being afraid to go back to Washington, D.C., George W. Bush took his own fears and spilled them out onto the rest of the nation. He and Cheney and Rumsfeld warned us of the constant threat of terrorism and spoke about mushroom clouds over American cities and rogue dictators stocking up on weapons of mass destruction. They scared us into two wars abroad and convinced us our safety at home depended on giving up our civil liberties. And thus came the Patriot Act and the National Defense Authorization Act that says the president can arrest and hold you forever without charges just because he decided to. We responded to Bush's fear-mongering by declaring you and me terrorist suspects if we want to board a plane and forcing us to be x-rayed, have our nude bodies put on display, or be groped by TSA agents. This is national hysteria. And even today, more than 3 years after Bush and his fear machine left the White House, and long after European countries started letting people keep their shoes on, we're all still behaving like we're scared to death and pulling our kids off planes and branding them as would-be bombers. 18-month-old Rihanna is not a terrorist. Neither is 7-year-old Dina Frank. They're just kids. And we're all supposed to be citizens living in the land of the free and the home of the brave. It's time we started acting like it. I got to tell you, I personally am not afraid. It is not possible to create a nation or an air infrastructure or anything else that is absolutely completely secure. We don't have absolute security. 50,000 people in America die every year just from car accidents. 500,000 people die in the United States every year. 470,000 died last year from tobacco. And some of those were secondhand exposures. Life is not safe. Life is not secure. But in this obsession to make our planes so safe and so, you know what makes me feel comfortable when I get on a plane? Because I do a fair amount of flying. I've got, 2 million miles on one airline and 1 million on another. The thing that makes me feel safe now, post 9/11, is not the airport security. That, I think, is largely useless. I can see a magnetometer. Okay, I understand that. X-ray my luggage, I don't care. But X-ray me? No thanks. The thing that makes me feel safe on an airplane is the other people on the plane with me. I mean, they took out a pilot, they took out a flight attendant the other day because they were acting crazy.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We are Americans. We're not cowards. We're not afraid. We don't need this security theater anymore, thank you very much. Let's start being like grown-ups. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception, Tom Hartman here with you, and Paul in Virginia. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've been listening to you for years. It's my first time to call you, so I'm very pleased.
Well, thank you.
Hey, you remember that Bob Dylan song about that said, keep a clean nose, watch the plane close? You remember that song?
I don't.
Yeah, he says, don't follow leaders, watch your parking meters.
Oh, this is Subterranean something blues?
But every time I hear about a terrorist arrest in America, I always find out that they throw in this little thing about nobody was really at risk, that it was actually an undercover agent. It's a sting operation. I have always believed it doesn't matter if it's a sting operation for terrorism or drugs or anything else. Anytime the police officers entrap someone into committing a crime they may not have done otherwise, it's not an effective law enforcement tool, and it certainly, but I know of them making absolutely no real terrorist arrests. They're all these undercover, and you know what they do is that they find people that, maybe they're mad at the United States or whatever, and they basically...
Paul, there have been some real terrorism arrests. Probably the most well-known is the guy, the Wannabomber, right? The guy who tried to blow up Times Square. But the point is, and I think that you're making this point brilliantly, is that there may be real terrorists out there who want to do nasty things, but the American perception of any kind of actual danger is obscured by the fact that, you know, all these stories we're hearing are stories of sting operations, of setups. And I think most Americans share your opinion that entrapping somebody, that enticing somebody to commit a crime, you know, it was particularly bad during the Bush administration when they had like those five guys down in, Miami, Florida? These guys were, I think four of the five of them were quite literally illiterate. They had no idea what they were doing. One of them didn't have shoes. The FBI bought him shoes. I mean, it's like, and they, oh, and let's make a tape, you know, down death to America or something like that. It's like, it was pathetic. And that's what people pay attention to. That's what people remember. And I think your point is well taken. And I totally agree with you that sting operations or so-called sting operations, that entrapment is no way to conduct law enforcement. It's just wrong. Thank you for the call. Diane in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hey, Diane, what's up?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Excuse me, my babysitter just came and handed me the phone back. Tom, when we were talking about Nick Romney before, mm-hmm. and this issue that he had when he was bullying and, saying now that he's a changed man,
yep.
I just find it to be really funny because it just seems like the only thing he's changed is he's now attacking the entire gay community and their liberty as human beings.
Instead of just one.
Cannot do. It's right. Kind of funny almost. You were speaking about the terrorism and the fear factor again. It's just gone crazy. But those two things are just funny. You know,
they're
not funny. They're frightening is what it is. They're frightening us and they're started. And the Congress is a fellow who's finally done something for his state in Michigan, Walker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's probably the first guy in Republicans done anything, because this whole term, nobody's done any work except try to not let Obama do anything or pass anything. And they just sit there, and I don't know where you can do that and not work. I mean, any job, you know, they just sit there all day and say no, no, no to everything.
Yeah.
So I think they should just probably be all like civil litigation.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if this works out for Scott Walker. But excellent point, Diane, thank you very much for the call. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle with the Occupy movement there. Mark, what's going on?
Hey, Tom. I'd like to bring people's attention to an in-depth two-page article in the Seattle Times that was published over the weekend, which talks about how the Occupy Wall Street movement is gaining more and more support from the middle class. And I was just notified today that the Times is going to publish my op-ed piece on austerity measures, because I believe that these corporate globalization schemes are at the very root of these global uprisings across the planet. And one of the reasons why the middle class in America is moving towards the occupiers, because now we're seeing something that was instituted in places like Bolivia and Mexico back in the 80s and 90s, being forced on Greece and potentially Ireland and Italy and these other countries in the Eurozone. But we're also experiencing it here in our own local communities, where our federal government, our state governments, and our city and county governments are cutting and slashing all of the education programs, social programs, and, you know, trying to privatize everything. So those of us who came out into the streets against the World Trade Organization a decade ago understand these issues, and we saw it coming a long time ago. I just think now it's coming home to roost for the American people, and I want to support anybody who's out there talking about austerity measures, because I think that's the real root of the problem all over the world and the reason that people are uprising from Tunisia to Greece to Wall Street in New York City.
Yeah. Austerity is really what it is that first they pump the economy up, and then they skim all the fat off the top, and then they wring it down and you know, kind of wring the water out of the curds, as it were, and wring the whey out. This metaphor only works for anybody who's ever tried to make cheese or butter, but in any case, and now they want to take the very last. I mean, you know, austerity is stealing the very last little bit that the middle class has left. I mean, that's what they're doing. It's like, you know, pump it up, get the middle class to put all their assets into things that can be stolen, then steal it, right? Take it away, and then basically rip them off as bad as you can for everything they have left until they're just totally broke. We've got a system in the United States now where if you want to even be, you know, eligible for certain types of medical services, you have to be completely broke. In other words, you have to make sure that the banksters have every last penny of yours before the government will step in. It's tragic. No other country in the world does this.
It seems like it's based on this idea that there's a limited amount of resources, and the global elite, which includes a lot of these international bankers and politicians that kind of work for them, their attitude seems to be that, you know, the 99% just isn't going to be able to share those resources because the people that are on the top are going to hoard them.
You're right on, right on. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. That's the bad, the good, the bad, and the very, very fidifrigously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good, the American people. According to a new poll released Wednesday, 52% of all likely 2012 voters say they will not vote for a candidate, quote, who will not commit to reducing money in politics, end quote. The poll, sponsored by the Democracy Corps and Public Campaign Action Fund, also shows that 73% of Americans believe we need a common sense limit on the amount of money spent on campaigns. So what does all this mean? It means that more and more Americans are fed up with billionaires like the Koch brothers pulling the strings in Washington. Money does not equal free speech. Let's keep our efforts going and remove money from politics for good. Go to movetoamend.org. The bad, Mitt Romney. At a campaign speech at a Colorado oil field yesterday, Mitt Romney attacked President Obama's energy policies, saying,
"His ideas about energy are simply out of date. We're applying policies from the past that just don't work."
Out of date? The only thing out of date is Romney's, and much of Washington's, support for big oil, which has been receiving government subsidies for the past century. And let's not forget, oil and other fossil fuels are just that, fossil fuels. Made from decomposed organic material from millions of years ago. Sorry, Mitt, but it's time we left oil where it belongs, in the past, and moved into a cleaner and greener future. And the very, very ugly Richard Murdoch. Shortly after beating Senator Dick Lugar in the Indiana Republican primary, Murdoch was asked what current congressman he would like to mentor him if he is elected. Murdoch replied, Senator Mike Lee. Mike Lee is the man who thinks FEMA, the FDA, and Medicaid are all unconstitutional. And let's not forget, he also thinks child labor laws violate the Constitution, too. Murdoch's view for America is one where children are in the workforce, dangerous drugs are handed out like candy, and the poor are left to suffer. And that is very, very ugly. Boy, that's mind-bogglingly ugly. Did you hear about the Bank of America yesterday? Their shareholders meeting got occupied. First of all, the kind of sad news is that the city fathers of Charlotte, North Carolina said this is an exceptional event, extraordinary event. That's the legal term. And therefore, free speech didn't matter anymore. The right of you not to be profiled, the right of you not to be your right not to be randomly searched. The Fourth Amendment, basically the First and Fourth Amendments and arguably the Fifth Amendments all got set aside. But in addition to that, the kind of good news is that, you know, there was a bunch of shareholder amendments put forward by shareholders to be voted on by the shareholders present at the meeting. The one that got the largest percentage of positive votes, none of them passed, but this one hit almost 30%, which is really high for a shareholder proposal at the meeting, was to require the Bank of America to be more transparent about their lobbying efforts, where they're spending their money, how they're spending it, who they're giving it to, what they're asking for, those kinds of things. This is their shareholders, their stockholders. 30%. It's really, really pretty amazing when you think about it. Oh, and the Republican response yesterday to President Obama coming out and, pun intended, coming out and saying that he's in favor of marriage equality. The Republican response in the House of Representatives was to actually pass a law. Now, it won't become a law because it would have to go through the Senate and it would have to be signed by the president, which ain't going to happen. So this is a symbolic measure. But they passed a law in the House of Representatives almost entirely Republican. I think there was one Democrat who voted for this thing. Seven Republicans voted against it. That said that it was against the law for the administration to use federal funds to argue in court that the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional, and that the president had to enforce it because the White House has basically put it on the back burner. It's pretty amazing. Kurt in Seattle. Hey, Kurt, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm hearing about Mitt Romney's hijinks and pranks back in the day. And
you mean his hate crime?
You know, yeah, and that's exactly what they're describing, what's going on in the Amish community in the either Pennsylvania or Ohio area, where in order to shame someone, a group of people goes and grabs somebody, holds them down, and cuts their hair off so that they're humiliated from that
right.
point
cuts
forward.
Their beard.
I believe
yeah.
there have been arrests that have been going on regarding that. So,
yep.
you know, and in today's time, Mitt would be arrested for hate crimes.
Yeah, arrested and prosecuted. Interesting and excellent point. Thank you, Kurt. Peter in Philadelphia. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? Can you turn off my...
You still there? You still?
Sorry, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can, yeah. What's up?
Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about genetics and just very briefly, you know, genes don't work on one side or the other. They work on a... like, for example, hair color isn't all black or all blonde. There's a scattering of shades and genetic influence. When it comes to sexuality, there are a number of studies. The best one I saw years ago, I haven't been able to find it again since, but a number of studies, at least half a dozen I can send to you tonight, that clearly show that men who identify themselves as having been homosexual for as long as they can remember have much higher levels of estrogen than heterosexual men. In fact, they have levels very close to heterosexual women. Of estrogen levels. So mm-hmm. if you kind of scale that down a little bit, it, suppose you have estrogen levels slightly less than homosexual men, but more than heterosexual men. Well, you know, it's easy to see how people may have conflicting sexual.
Then you end up as Marcus Bachman.
I'm sorry?
Then you end up as Marcus Bachman. Somebody who seems gay but is married to a woman and has kids.
Well,
I'm making a joke. I'm sorry, a bad joke. My point is that even if being gay or not gay is a spectrum, as long as there is one person on that spectrum who is gay, and obviously there's a lot more than one, we should not be denying them rights.
Well, exactly. In fact, I was going to suggest it. I would suggest it's more than a civil rights issue, because if you look at it that way, whether or not they're entirely born or they choose, it doesn't matter. The point is, why should there be any shame ascribed to? Why should there be any shame at all attached to someone's sexual orientation? And that becomes an issue of humanity, not just civil rights, to me.
Yeah.
Especially because, again, it's as genetic as hair color. And you know, people can choose hair color, change hair color, but there is a hair color. Give it to you.
Yeah, but they can't change their skin color. I think that's probably a better analogy. But point is well taken, Peter. Point is well taken. Thanks for calling and making it. Martina in Los Angeles. Hey, Martina, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Something's bugging me for a few weeks. I'm German, and we oppose, as the Germans, we oppose this austerity measures to other nations. What I'm asking myself, and maybe you can help me, is, do you think that might be because we're very stubborn and we're very accurate and throughout the past from the First World War and the Second World War, that might be that we're very hard on others, that we expect others to be like we are?
There is having lived there for a year, there is kind of a hard edge to German culture, and there's a hardiness and a, you know, just push through no matter how rough it is to German
right.
culture. And I think that, you know, in some ways that reflects in the language and even in the use of metaphor. But no, I think what's going on, Martina, is that Germany is a very, very prosperous nation, and they're a very prosperous nation in large part because of the laws that they put into place that bring labor, you know, if all the large companies in Germany by law are required to have half their board of directors made up of members of organized labor, and therefore they don't offshore their products. They don't send jobs overseas like this the transnational companies based in the United States do. They keep their, you know, and so Germany has remained prosperous. And as a consequence of that prosperity, when Europe started going down the tubes and the European Central Bank needed cash, they went to Germany to get that cash. And then, you know, the countries that were in trouble, like Greece and Portugal and Ireland and Spain, needed cash from the ECB. And so they gave that cash, you know, they loaned that cash to those countries. And the Germans are sitting there going, wait a minute, we were the good people, you know, we saved, we worked our butts off, we protected our nation, and then we loaned this money out, and now these people are rioting in the streets and saying they don't want to pay it back. And so that, I think, is why there is such support for Angela Merkel's position in Germany, that austerity must be imposed on these countries. Frankly, somebody needs to tell the German people that if you want to have the money paid back to you by the Greeks or by the Spanish or by the Irish or whatever, if you want to have that money paid back, you're far more likely to get it paid back by letting those countries stimulate their economies, jump-starting them out of the depression, putting their people back to work so that they're paying taxes, and then you'll have an economy that's generating, you know, that's throwing off enough cash that they can take that money and pay Germany back. Austerity is strangling them, and that hasn't that hasn't yet sunk into the German people. I think it's starting. People, you know, you're starting to see that debate in Der Spiegel and Die Welt and other German publications, or at least some discussion of that. You weren't a few months ago.
Right.
But, you know,
also the people that was opposed to austerity measures died out. They're not alive anymore. Back then, in the 1940s and 50s, until we turned the economy around,
yeah,
and it was imposed because our country was just ruined.
Yes, it was, and there were some important lessons learned out of World War II, and the most important one, I think, for the Germans was, you know, to be a community, to be together, to work together. Martina, thank you very much for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Auf Wiederhören, or Auf Wiedersehen. Thank you. We'll be right back. 866-987-THO.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the files of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
You tell him, Leonard. Spoken like a good Canadian. Sam in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Sam, what's up?
How are you? Hey, Tom, I love you. I agree with you 90% of
but!
The time. But, yeah, I tell you, I mean, as far as security in the airports, what would you do? Would you, like, relax all the standards that we have currently? Because, frankly, I would be scared to travel if that was the case.
Yeah, I first of all, I don't know how old you are, but I remember flying when there was nothing. You would literally walk into the airport. If you already had a ticket, you'd walk into the airport, you'd walk up to the plane, you'd get on the plane, and off you go.
Yeah.
And you know, that's how it was up until, my recollection is, the late 80s, early 90s. I'm not sure. Somewhere around there. But, you know, there was no security. There was nothing. And maybe it was the 70s. I frankly don't remember when it first appeared, but there was, you know, there was that spate of hijackings of planes to Cuba. And then we got the 7-Eleven guys, you know, running our bags through the X-ray machines and having us walk through magnetometers. I actually, you know, I'm not all that offended by a magnetometer and an X-ray machine for my bag. Although and frankly, I think that's probably, I mean, there's got to be some minimum rational threshold, and that's probably it. And the reason why I think that's probably it is because 2 weeks ago I had dinner with the President of the United States and his wife at the correspondence dinner. I mean, me and 400 of his best friends, right? But nonetheless, I was in the room with him. And to get into that room, the Secret Service and the TSA were there running security. To get into that room, I had to walk through a magnetometer, and I had to take any metal that I had in my pockets out of my pockets and hand them to a guy. I mean, they didn't even have an X-ray machine there. And if you set off the magnetometer and you insisted that you had no metal in your pockets, then they had a wand that they went over you. Remember how they used to do that? That's what
sure.
they do right now if you're going to hang out with the President of the United States. Now, you tell me that the people who really run this country and, you know, who are responsible for our security decisions don't think that the security and safety of the President of the United States is as important as the security and safety of an airplane taking off from Fort Lauderdale Airport, you know, with an 18-month-old on it that they're saying is a terrorist?
I can tell you, I actually, while I was in college in 1980, I worked airport security here in the Cleveland area.
Okay, so it must have started in the late 70s.
Yeah.
But I'm an old fart here. You know, I do remember just walking up to the plane. And yeah. Maybe it was the 60s or 70s, but
I think it was a little earlier prior, you know, with all the hijackings.
Yeah.
I mean, I checked, you know, I personally checked people back then. I checked wheelchairs. But not, you know, not for...
Not hysterically. And you weren't groping, you know, 5-year-olds or 90-year-olds who were sitting there. And Louise and I were in Sweden a couple of months ago. We spent, you know, we did this show for a week, you know, from Iceland and from Sweden. And with a little help from Carl Frisch, and you know, he filled in while we were traveling. And I remember going through Swedish security. And I'm coming up, and they've got the magnetometer and the x-ray machine that you put your bags through, right? And I said, should I take my shoes off? And the woman laughed at me. I mean, literally laughed at me. She said, we're not afraid like you Americans are.
All right.
Everybody's wearing their shoes. Europe has given up on this. They don't have the Chertoff porno x-ray scanners in Europe. And so, you know,
you're probably right, but I'm telling you, it would take some getting used to at this point now.
Yeah, well, I'm ready to get used to it. I'm tired of being groped and x-rayed. And I'm not getting x-rayed anymore. Whenever I go to the airport, I say, just give me the grope. And, you know, then they punish you for 5 or 10 minutes. So I always budget the extra 10 minutes in to get there, because I know I'm going to have to stand there and wait for somebody to come over. But, you know, it's like no more porno x-ray scanners for me. When they won't let their own employees wear the badges that measure exposure, dosimeters, when they won't let their own employees wear dosimeters to determine if they're being exposed to x-rays, and the companies that manufacture these things will not release the safety studies, then I'm not going to stand in one of those machines. It's just that simple. And I think that we've gone around the bend in being terrified and frightened and behaving like George Bush after 9/11 when he's hopscotching around the country, frightened to death that somebody's going to get him. I'm not afraid. I'm sorry. As I said, I think that the other people on the plane are going to keep me safe. Bert in South Carolina. Hey, Bert, what's up?
Hey, Tom, man. Love your show. First of all, I guess I got to confess I am a extreme right-wing conservative evangelical Christian and love listening to you, actually. One thing I think our party has wrong, though, is the whole discriminatory focus it has on certain either races or lifestyles of people. I've been an evangelical Christian. You cannot ignore kind of the directive of the Bible to love all people.
Yeah, who would Jesus discriminate against?
Yeah, nobody. And,
right.
And so last night when Obama said, I mean, and he said it, he said, we are practicing Christians and this is the only thing we can do. And I thought, wow, that's pretty awesome. You know, it just really kind of hit home with me. And, I totally agreed with him and I guess I probably need to switch parties at some point because, it just doesn't look good on this side anymore.
Well, that's a pretty amazing statement, Bert. How long have you been a Republican?
All my life, in you know, late 40s, and I just always thought it was a value issue, but I see them making issues of non-issues, and, you know, I mean, there's some things I disagree with. Obviously, we talk about abortion, but then again, I'm not in this situation. I've never had to have to choose to have one, so who
sure.
am I to say?
Yeah. Well, and beyond anyway, that, there are Democrats who are pro-life, you know, who are anti-abortion. That's not a totally partisan issue. In fact, there's a whole group called Democrats for Life.
Well, I mean, to me, one of the most amazing things that we ignore is there are typically two victims in that situation, and we ignore the poor woman all the time.
Yeah. Well, seems to be the cause du jour these days is to ignore the women. But Bert, thank you for sharing, calling and sharing your conversion experience, your Road to Damascus experience here. It was very interesting to hear. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening to SiriusXM. So tomorrow is Friday. It'll be Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be with us taking your calls in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. So, and then anything goes Friday. So whatever you've been saving up all week, get off your chest. Get ready. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great weekend or have a great evening. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Tag, you're it. See you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.